most disturbing thing to me is how could John Marvin do this in front of a mother, wife, and especially two small children?
The man convicted of killing two Hoonah police officers is sentenced. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new UN treaty that doesn't have the support of Alaska's senators.
It puts an end to what some call the body bag approach to international arms control.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
John Marvin Jr. has been sentenced to 198 years in prison for the murder of two Hoonah police officers. The 47-year-old Hoonah resident will essentially spend the rest of his life in prison for gunning down two officers in front of their families and then holding other officers at bay in a standoff for more than a day. KTOO's Matt Miller reports from Juneau.
Superior Court Judge David George called Marvin a dangerous individual during a hearing on Friday morning.
The offense was committed deliberately. It was motivated by a perception of need to exact revenge. It was executed without any immediately preceding, precipitating event. This was not in anger.
Marvin was convicted during a jury trial in November of the murder of Hoonah Police Sergeant Tony Wallace and Officer Matthew Tokaoka. They were gunned down as they socialized with family members on Front Street in Hoonah, August 28th of 2010. Tokaoka's widow Haley says their family had spent that day fishing. What was the best day of their lives had turned into the worst day of their lives.
I never thought I would be a widow with two small children at the age of 30. But the most disturbing thing to me is how could and why did John Marvin do this in front of a mother, wife, and especially two small children, the bullet just inches away from them.
She suggested that it was revenge for an incident a year earlier when Marvin was arrested by officers. Debbie Green, mother of Wallace, listened to the sentencing hearing from her home in Louisiana. Marvin's 99-year sentence for the murder of Wallace while serving as an officer in the performance of his duty is specified in statute and does not allow for parole. But the judge had discretion in a range between 20 and 99 years for the murder of Tokaoka, who was off duty at the time. The judge imposed the maximum 99 years. Judge George cited the need for deterrence and Marvin's isolation as he ordered that both sentences be served consecutively. Marvin also made his own comments to the court in a 15-minute, largely rambling and incoherent monologue about the case's proceedings being out of order and other issues. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Earlier this week, the United Nations General Assembly overwhelmingly approved a treaty regulating the global arms trade. The United States supports the treaty, but as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, it faces stiff opposition in the Senate, where both Alaska senators are against the agreement.
The UN Global Arms Trade Treaty took 7 years to negotiate. It aims to block the sale of weapons to countries charged with crimes against humanity, prevent future genocide, and assure terrorists won't get their hands on tanks, artillery, and helicopters. Scott Stegen is a senior policy advisor with Oxfam America, a group that supports the treaty. He says the new rules would force arms dealers to weigh human rights equally with profit.
It puts an end to what some call the body bag approach to international arms control, where countries wait until a situation becomes really bad, a situation like Syria right now or previously in the Democratic Republic of Congo or Sudan, where the body bags have to pile up really high before the international community does anything to stop arms flowing into those countries.
50 countries will need to ratify the treaty. In the United States, only the Senate does so, and because of the magnitude of these treaties, they require 67 votes.
Anything with the UN on it is almost dead on arrival in the Senate.
Mark Helmke is a longtime aide to former Senator Richard Lugar. Lugar, a moderate Republican and two-time chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, lost a primary campaign last year. Helmke says the administration knows there's no chance of ratification in the Senate, but it needs to make a show of support to distance itself from the three countries that voted against the treaty, Iran, North Korea, and Syria. And in the Senate, opposing the treaty gives conservatives a chance to rile a base opposed to the United Nations.
Every time a UN treaty comes up, the opposition can raise a lot of money and make a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails to people who believe that somehow blue-helmeted people are going to come in and confiscate our guns.
Helmke, who now teaches at Trine University in Indiana, says the Senate could use a Republican internationalist like his former boss to get colleagues on board. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who declined an interview for this story, supports the separate UN Law of the Sea treaty, and she's tried to recruit her fellow Republicans to support that cause. But on this international agreement, she stands with her party in opposition. Senator Murkowski signed a letter to President Obama saying she worries the treaty will enforce international arms regulations on Americans. Senator Mark Begich is one of the few Democrats who signed the letter.
It's going to be a problem if you cannot differentiate between domestic trade and international trade. And that treaty melds it all together. And therefore, it does infringe and jeopardize, I believe, the Second Amendment rights of this country.
The National Rifle Association has maintained that argument as well. But Oxfam America's Scott Stegen says the treaty clearly lays out its boundaries, noting that the preamble states domestic regulations will be handled within the country.
The treaty does not undermine the Second Amendment in any way whatsoever. This treaty is only about the cross-border trade of armaments.
Stegen warns the treaty will not become law for several more years. Countries can begin signing on to the treaty in June, and then the ratification battle will begin. There's no indication whether Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid would bring the treaty to the floor before the next election in 2014. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Another major military exercise has been canceled. The Alaskan Command announced this morning that it will not hold Northern Edge 2013. The event, held every other year, was scheduled for the last 2 weeks of June. It's the largest military training exercise in Alaska, spanning the entire state and Gulf of Alaska. Alaska Command spokeswoman Captain Tanya Bryan says the 2013 event fell victim to federal budget cuts.
It's been canceled because of the current fiscal constraints and other competing operational priorities. And this U.S.-only exercise represented one area where Pacific Command could reassign its people and resources to maintain required readiness in the region.
Captain Bryan says about 9,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, and more than 200 aircraft were scheduled to participate in Northern Edge. She says the cancellation does not mean the exercise won't be held in future years. It's the second major military training exercise to be canceled in recent weeks due to the federal budget sequester. The Air Force called off its first red flag event of the year last month. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a volunteer program to make proms magical for rural students.
We're kind of like their fairy godmothers coming in to help them make sure that they have everything they need to have the opportunity to go to the prom if they wish.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Matsu Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Anchorage union leaders have filed to hold a referendum that would repeal an ordinance recently passed by the Assembly. Meanwhile, the Assembly chair says he's going to introduce a new ordinance that will better outline how public hearings work. As KSKA's Daisha Eaton explains, at the center of the story is a controversial ordinance that strips unions of power.
The Anchorage Assembly ended public hearings on the controversial ordinance after listening to 4 5-hour evenings of public testimony from 285 people. The rewrite of Municipal Labor Code passed by a vote of 6-5 on March 26th. The next week, voters let Anchorage Assembly Chair Ernie Hall know they were dissatisfied. Thousands of voters in his West Anchorage Assembly District wrote in a last-minute candidate, Nick Moe. At the end of election night, Hall led Moe by just 93 votes. Who wins won't be determined for at least a week after question and absentee ballots are reviewed and counted. Hall says, meanwhile, he's introducing a new ordinance that will require people sign up ahead of time in order to give public testimony.
It's basically going to set up the procedure protocol for taking public testimony. It will be very clear, and this will never be a problem in the future, because as chair, you know, I ask, okay, how's this been handled in the past? And they said, well, sometimes we do sign-up sheets, sometimes we do this. Nobody had a written protocol. There will be one.
Union leaders say that's a bad idea.
The intent of the way that's written is for the community to be able to provide their input to these very important things. And I think it was left gray so that they could make the decision to allow all of these people to talk and to be heard and have their voice be heard. And they made a conscious decision to say, we know there are more of you that are ready and waiting, but we just don't want to hear it right now.
Sergeant Gerard Aslin, who represents the Anchorage Police Department Employees Association, says changing the protocol to require the public to sign up ahead of time to testify could potentially limit busy working people from turning out to get involved in the public process. Besides, the public testimony issue is a red herring, Aslin says. Wednesday, union leaders filed paperwork applying to hold a referendum on AO 37. Aslin says they want to repeal the ordinance.
And so we have submitted the initial petition to the city, which kind of gets that ball rolling. The administration has 10 working days to respond to our initial application. The next step would be that the city clerk's office would then reply back to us with the official signature gathering pages, as well as official final language that would eventually be presented to the voters.
The municipal clerk's office and the municipality's legal department are reviewing the application. If the application to hold the referendum is approved, union leaders will have to collect more than 7,000 signatures, or signatures equaling 10% of the voters that voted in the last mayoral race. Once the signatures are submitted and certified, the assembly is required to hold a special election within 75 days, theoretically in late August or in early September. The assembly could vote to hold the referendum later, but the ordinance would have to be suspended until then. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A Fairbanks man survived a crevasse fall on a glacier near Delta Junction yesterday. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, he was rescued unscathed despite a long fall and hours trapped in the ice.
Tom Douglas was part of a team conducting a snow and ice survey on the Jarvis Glacier near Black Rapids, south of Delta Junction. Douglas, who works with the Cold Regions Research Laboratory at Fort Wainwright, was riding a snow machine when a snow bridge spanning a crevasse gave way, sending him into the abyss. He came to rest on a ledge with his machine wedged above him. Co-workers determined Douglas was uninjured, but they could not get him out and went for help. Air National Guard Major Guy Hayes says a pararescue team arrived via helicopter.
Got on scene there late last night and carefully approached the crevasse where we found the injured snowmobiler down about 90 feet down.
Major Hayes says Douglas, who was dressed for the cold, was not hurt despite hours in the ice and the long fall.
Fortunately, the crevasse was only about 3 feet wide, and I think that kind of helped him as he fell down it. There was friction involved in the fall, helped him from falling uncontrollably, and he was uninjured.
Hayes says the team pulled Douglas from the crevasse using a rope and pulley system around 11:30 Thursday night. The Cold Regions Research and Engineering Lab reports Douglas, an experienced mountaineer, was back working in the field today. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Alaska Moose Federation is working with an Alaska Native entity on a moose diversion project near Big Lake. The Federation has announced a partnership with an engineering training group to use heavy equipment to spur willow growth on up to 200 acres of land owned by the Kanik'atnu Village Corporation. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Alaska Moose Federation Executive Director Gary Olson says the project will keep moose from browsing along the park's highway corridor, thus helping to reduce moose auto collisions. The Federation has launched programs the past couple of winters, one to remove live moose away from roadways, another to collect the animals' carcasses when moose run afoul of traffic. Olson says the latest plan will lure moose away from the road by providing a smorgasbord of moosey delights.
We're trying to do some different programs now that'll actually encourage the moose to live back in the woods rather than hanging around these highway corridors.
The project is taking place in an area that was charred by the Miller's Reach wildfire about 15 years ago.
And there's a lot of moose in there. And so if we're able to go in and demonstrate how industry can assist in these conservation programs, we're hoping this demonstration project provides a model that the state and local governments and agencies can actually try to do in more areas to enhance more habitat.
The three-way partnership is using donated funds and equipment to meet expenses. Alaska Operating Engineers will provide a G8 Caterpillar bulldozer and an apprentice operator and an instructor for the job. The dozer will pull a 40,000-pound roller chopper behind it to crush more than 4 acres of willow an hour.
It's a big drum with cutting discs on it. And what it does is it replicates how, after a natural fire, you get all that regenerated willow and birch.
The downed trees spur the generation of new growth in the understory that is attractive to moose.
The moose has the biggest nose on the continent, and if there's food out there, they're going to find it.
Tom Harris is CEO of Kanikatnu and an advocate for habitat enhancement programs aimed at increasing the numbers of moose. He says the Moose Federation's project also could provide hunting opportunities. Harris says urban hunters are competing with rural Alaska hunters for the same moose.
If we can provide an increased chance for a harvest on the road system, then that hunter is less likely to want to go to a remote community and be competing for a moose that's critical to the western or rural villages of Alaska. As a result of that, a loss of a moose to a rural family can be as much as a replacement cost of 8 to 10 permanent funds.
Harris says if there are more moose in the valley, urban hunters won't have to fly out to rural Alaska for opportunities. State Fish and Game Assistant Director of Wildlife Conservation Tony Cavalock says the program is on private land and Fish and Game has not been consulted.
We have a question about the value of doing that specific for moose in that area. I can't imagine it's going to have a significant increase in moose use. This will be a small postage stamp in a bigger area.
And it is not certain that the land in question has the biological potential for enhanced habitat. Fish and Game wildlife physiologist Bill Collins says moose may linger in an area where food is tasty, but in general, the animals have fixed habits and tend to traverse the same terrain year after year. Olson says the program got started over a week ago, but workers are taking a temporary break due to spongy spring conditions. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The National Weather Service is predicting another round of significant snow for south-central Alaska from the Mat-Su Valley down to the Kenai Peninsula this weekend. The storm is expected to hit Saturday afternoon, with the heaviest snowfall Saturday evening into Sunday morning. The forecast calls for between 4 and 10 inches of snow in the Anchorage area, with the highest amounts along the hillside. Dave Snyder is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Anchorage. He says big snows aren't especially unusual this time of year.
Three of our top five highest snowfall totals for just one day occur in March and April. So back in 2008, I think we set a record about this time of the year for 15.5 inches of snow. So it can come down, and it can come down pretty hard and fast as well, even in this late part of the wintertime or early spring, if you like to call it that.
Snyder says even more snow is forecast for the region for the early part of next week.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugiak,
Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Aleknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ariel Van Cleve. This week on AK, prom. Getting ready for prom can be a time-consuming process, and finding the right dress isn't easy, especially when you live in rural Alaska. At Sitka's Mount Edgecombe High, the state-run boarding school, students got special treatment recently from a group of volunteers, most of whom work for Alaska Airlines. KCAW's Ann Bryce has the story.
When Terry Bogren first came to Mount Edgecombe in Sitka 6 years ago, she didn't know how much of an impact the experience would have on her life.
One of my nieces went to school here, and I was here helping her and her friends get their hair done, do their hair for prom, and some of the girls weren't going because they didn't have dresses and stuff.
She helped a few girls get ready the best she could, but she saw a need that wasn't being met. Girls and boys who wanted to go to prom didn't, because they had a hard time finding outfits that worked for them and that they could afford. Shortly after, Bogren got a job with Alaska Airlines in Seattle. It was just after the company's 75th anniversary ball.
And I knew that a lot of people had dresses, and most people buy formal dresses and wear them only once.
So Bogren had them dry cleaned and brought them with her to Mount Edgecombe's next prom.
And their families are all, they're not here, so we're kind of like their fairy godmothers coming in to help them make sure that they have everything they need to have the opportunity to go to the prom if they wish.
She calls it the Prom Princess Program. It started out with just five of Bogren's friends working on alterations, hair, and makeup. Now in its fifth year, there are more than 40 volunteers, many of whom are Alaska Airlines or Horizon employees, who donate their time and resources. It's a few hours before prom, and around 100 students wait in lines at different stations in the main girls' dorm. Anna Springer is a junior at Mount Edgecombe. This is her third year going to prom, and she has a lot of admirers.
Oh, you are beautiful, and you're cute. Look at you.
She steps onto a table to show off her dress to a room full of people who take photos of her outfit.
It is a golden yellow with star beaded areas. Do you really think I want to go to dinner in a different dress and then come back and change into this dress?
Yeah.
No.
There are women painting nails under bright lights, curling hair and applying makeup. There's a flower station where people are putting together boutonnieres and corsages, and a photographer taking their photos after they're all dressed up and ready to go. Debbie Eggemeyer owns Deb's Nails and Hands in Kodiak. She closed her business for the weekend so she could come to Sitka and join in the effort.
I brought gel polish, so it's the shellac, so it'll stay on them anywhere from 7 to 10 days. They don't have to worry about it. They can't mess it up. I brought a lot of polish, so they've got a lot to choose from.
Mandy Odenheimer is a station manager for Alaska Airlines in Sitka. She's been a seamstress for this event for the past 3 years. She soon convinced her friend Janet Warner, a retired Alaska Airlines employee and former tailor for Nordstrom, to join her.
Don't you think that looked nice?
That's not soft in the other beads. Because she just said the beads look so cheap. Yeah. You should have seen the other dress she was willing to wear because she wouldn't take this one. Broke my heart.
Yeah, it was just sad.
The women make alterations to more than 130 dresses before the prom. The men's warehouse provides tuxes for half the regular rental price, and many Alaska Airlines employees sponsor students, so the guys can have a tux for free. Dresses are donated from all over the country. Bogren says getting ready for the dance may now be the highlight of the event.
Last year we did have a girl come back early and we were wondering why she came back, and we asked her and she said that the prom was kind of boring, and she said the best part about the prom was getting ready for it.
But still, the students are excited for the main event. Girls and a handful of guys are huddled in big groups dancing to a song by Rihanna. Strings of people walk in, show their tickets, and trail each other to a seating area in the back. It feels like most high school dances, except everyone is exceptionally, you guessed it, well-dressed. Sequence shimmers and flowing bright fabrics light up the dark room. So even if prom is just one night, for Mount Edgecombe students, it's one classy night to remember. For AK, I'm Ann Bryce.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Upper Kalskag, a community of about 200 people on the Kuskokwim River east of Bethel.
My name is Annie Lou Williams, and I'm from the city of Upper Kalskag.
when you first come to Cascade, if you're getting off the plane, the first thing you will notice, we have a beautiful mountain up here, and it's our Cascade Hill. And then right across from it is our Rocky Hill, which is called Rocky because there's so much on it. Main jobs that we have here in Cascade is our Muskwak School District, and then also the city and the tribe. And then we have firefighting in the summer. There's a few people that trap, not too many. Oh, you can go water ski, you can go berry picking, you can cut fish, you can go hunt moose, you can go hiking up the hill, you can go four-wheeler riding. We have our beautiful hill where there's so many berries up there. We have blackberries, we have red berries, we have blueberries. Right now, the important issue that we are having is our subsistence fishing. Because of the dwindling fish, people are being concerned about that. And because we live off the land with our moose and especially fishing, there are different ways that you can take care of the fish for subsistence use mainly. And that's one of our main concerns that we're having because of the dwindling of the fish. So I think the number one priority that we have is our fish, our concern. And the other is getting jobs and education for our young men and women.
That was Annie Lou Williams from Upper Kalskag. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Alex Duerre, Ann Bryce, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matt Miller in Juneau, Dan Ross in Fairbanks, and Dacia Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. Ariel Van Cleve was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Kristen Spack is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.